Escape Pod, episode 213. Today's story: The Monkey Will Never Be Rid of Its Black Pants, by Rachel Swirsky.
Hello, welcome to Escape Pod. I, by Vectron, am Alistair, and this week's story comes to us from Rachel Swirsky. That name may well be familiar to you from our sister blog, Podcastle, and if it isn't, go there now and sample the amazing stories Rachel and her co-editor Anne Leckie regularly put up. But that name should also be familiar to you as a writer. Rachel's work has appeared in Subterranean, Flashquake, Interzone, the English anthology glorifying terrorism, Spacesuits and Six Guns, and much, much more. Your narrator this week is me, so without further ado, it's story time. A Monkey Will Never Be Rid of Its Black Hands, by Rachel Swirsky. Papa and Uncle Fomba told me if I didn't join the army, they would kill me. They didn't. They cut off my hands. This was after US forces marched on Syria, but before we invaded Lebanon. On every city block, posters of Uncle Sam entreated every Tom, Duke, and Harun to get blown up in the name of freedom. Papa and Fomba gave me 2 weeks to enlist. I ran for Canada. They caught me. Fomba took me to Papa's shed and handcuffed me to a 2x4. "You can't scare me," I said. "We're not trying to scare you," said Fomba. "Get the knife, Bayo." Papa went. Fomba was younger in years, but elder in authority. "How far are you going to take this?" Fomba put his hands over my wrists and grinned. "Cocky Momodu. Strutting Momodu. Don't depend on a dead man's shoes when you don't know their size. That's a proverb from Sierra Leone. Don't count your chickens when you may still get a piece of shrapnel eggshell in the gut." Papa and I emigrated from Sierra Leone as refugees when I was a toddler. Fomba came 8 years later. Fomba had been conscripted by the Revolutionary United Front at 9 years old. They made him shoot his parents so he wouldn't have a home to run away to. You'd think Papa would have hated him for that, but when Fomba started sending letters to the US, Papa was quick enough to get him here. The RUF terrorized Sierra Leone for 10 years, murdering hundreds of thousands, including my mother. Other than hating the government, they had no philosophy, so Fomba was used to militarism without ideals. He took to American nationalism faster than American beer. He liked to say, "When you go to a country when people dance on 1 foot, you should dance on 1 foot. If you dance on 2 feet, they'll cut them out from under you." Every afternoon of my childhood, my father and I sat with Fomba while he drank beer and quoted proverbs like, "Cooked beans don't want cold water, only hot," which meant children needed punishing. Other Africans didn't like that Fomba had been part of the RUF, so they wouldn't be around us. Fomba joined a military history society and befriended whites. The Civil War fascinated him, especially the Confederates. Other society members gave him old rifles that he cannibalized to make new guns. They leant against the wall in Papa's shed, black and slender, like shadows. In summer, the three of us lay on the floor with our shirts off, and Fomba doused himself with beer. Wet and sticky, he got nostalgic for the RUF. During harvest, we went into the villages to find women growing crops. We had to stop them from finishing the harvest, or the food would go straight to the government dogs. We chased them through the plantains and cassava until they went to ground. And then we waited. I remember Fomba's grin, viewed sideways as I lay next to him, the corners of his mouth sidling up his cheeks. They always gave themselves away. They shouted or whimpered or came out after dusk, and we grabbed them, and that is when we cut off their hands. By the time Papa brought the butcher's knife, I couldn't remember how I'd ever thought they were joking. For Fomba, this was justice. He looked saner at that moment than he did downing beers over scavenged guns or maps of Gettysburg. Before he did it, he quoted another proverb from Sierra Leone. A monkey will never be rid of its black hands. It meant there was nothing I could do to cleanse myself. As the cut fell, I saw no blood. Instead, I had a vision of my dead hands rising like black ghosts from my wrists. I passed out before the knife hit the bone. Amputation has been a terrorist tactic in Africa since the Belgians required their officers to provide one human hand for every bullet they shot. After Fomba cut me, America added this tradition to its glorious melting pot and did what Americans do so well. Made lots and lots of copies. The first copycat cut off his son's hands on the family dining table, 3 days after Papa and Fomba did me. He shouted the Pledge of Allegiance as police hauled him off. Isolated crimes scattered across the United States like drops of blood, seeping across the map as the rate of incidents increased. During July, mutilations reached a high of 3 per day. Student protesters attached red ribbons to their wrists, and counter-protesters threatened to help them stop pretending. In Texas and North Carolina, juries commended perpetrators at the same time as they pronounced guilty verdicts. Then, in September, a gang of soldiers on leave chased a 22-year-old off the road. He pleaded that he was exempt on account of fibromyalgia. They didn't believe him. When his mother appeared on TV with his medical record, the fever broke. There are almost 400 of us. They call us the Handless. Demographically, we're small, but at a time when the fighting in the Middle East and Islamic Africa was a mundane fact of political life, we polarized America. Renewed patriotism inspired huge numbers of red, white, and blue-blooded jingoists to volunteer for the front, while newly converted pacifists bled their hearts at any Handless too slow to escape. People assume I didn't join the war because I didn't want to kill innocents. They remember I owned a t-shirt that read, "Give peace a chance." They forget I belonged to no peace organizations, expressed no opinions on the war, watched as many violent movies as anyone else. I wasn't afraid of killing people, but there was no way I was willing to die. After Fomba cut me, the physicians tried to fit me with prosthetics, but plastic and metal ignited pain in my missing hands, reminding my brain to grieve for severed nerves. Most amputees suffer phantom pain. Mine was exceptional. No test could explain it. No analgesic douse it. The pain amplified until finally I told the doctors to stuff the damn prosthetics where fists went best and marched out of the hospital. I've bared my naked wounds since. I am what Fomba made me. Popper and Fomba would have gotten 10 years in the normal rote of the legal system, but the judge increased the sentence to 25 for deliberate cruelty. I haven't seen them since. I testified at the trial, but I get the news like everyone else. Papa got caught in another man's brawl, took a knife in the ribs. They buried him in state ground behind the prison. Fomba is still behind bars, but he believes the food is made from dead inmates, so he won't eat. Media photos show him growing skinnier and skinnier, becoming lean and vicious as his scavenged guns. I can't do much for myself anymore. I learned how, at first, but everything's so much harder when you don't have hands. So when I got Minna, I let her do it. A lot of girls want to find out what it would be like to screw a hero with no hands. They approach me at the bar, and they talk about something banal, and then they start dropping kisses on my neck and shoulders, and I am supposed to act the grateful cripple. They have no idea that there'll be another girl like them along in 15 minutes. That's one thing I've learned, having no hands. Women want to cut men into pieces. Minna approached me late in the evening. After I was drunk on things you don't look stupid sucking through a straw, she was heavy and she was colourless, and her reflection smeared in the mirror behind the bar, giving her a fleshy white halo. The beads on her shirt fractured my shadow into jagged lines, like black fingers over her breasts. I was considering whether or not I wanted to fuck her. Even dirty water can put out a fire, when she said, "Your stumps are a mess." Her hands were chubby, with runt-like fingers. Translucent white skin shot through with blue veins like expensive cheese. When I didn't answer, she said, "What's it like having no hands?" Her tone held no quaver, just blunt curiosity. And that's when I decided to take her to my apartment. She was fatter than I'd had, but a vehicle is never too big for its driver. A man can always have a big woman. After a few weeks, her things started to appear in my apartment. It was as though a tide had come in and deposited Afghans and German novels and balls of yarn, knitting needles. There were also things I didn't let on bothered me. Angora gloves, clippers, nail polish. I fired my very expensive nurse and Minna took over. We fit together. She accepted my tongue because I had no fingers to give her, then sat astride me and pulled my penis in since I couldn't adjust myself. She claimed that she'd felt touched all over when we slept together. "You have 1,000 ghost fingers," she said. At night she tucked the quilt under my chin and opened the window enough so I wouldn't be hot, but not too much so I wouldn't be cold. I didn't like her holding me when I pissed or cleaning the toilet if I missed on my own. I didn't mind being fed, but I didn't like her to wipe up my drool, and I hated her reaching inside my mouth. After she fed me corn on the cob, I stayed silent about the strings, sawing at my gums. She tried to peek into my closed mouth and ask, "You still have a tongue, right?" Nights we spent by the fire, cocooned in her afghans. We rolled next to each other in a full tactile press that almost made hands irrelevant. She asks very stupid questions like, "Are you angry, Momadou?" "Of course I'm angry." "It's all right for you to be angry," she allowed, and then she called me courageous for refusing to participate in the slaughter and lauded me for sacrificing my hands. I never responded to that, just tried to make out her chubby fingers under the afghan, whether they were tugging at loose threads or stroking the fabric or touching her concealed flesh. As I thought about her hands, bright knives of phantom pain daggered to my elbows. "How do you feel about the copycat?" "It's tragic. It must be hard to be the first. I mean, the talk shows treat you like an exhibit in a freak show. You get used to it. Do you regret not seeing your father before he died?" "My father was a puppet, not a man. You don't go to a puppet's deathbed." "What about your uncle? Do you want to see him?" "The sooner Fomba manages to starve himself, the sooner I can spit on his grave." And then she ducked her head and her bangs fell over her eyes. "Have there been other women who wanted to?" "Because you're famous." "Yes, baby, but you're the best." I met Barry working a talk show 4 months ago. I get most of my money from that and sitting in the background while politicians make speeches. Talk shows want short-sleeved t-shirts in navy or purple or goldenrod, and they want you to sit with your hands folded in your lap so they can pan from your face to your stumps. Democrats want white button-up shirts with the cuffs pulled over the wrists for subtle emphasis. There's a Democrat face, too, which involves sucking in my cheeks and widening my eyes until I looked like a hooked fish. Republicans want a dark suit jacket and a somber expression. Patriotism columnist took the first 5 minutes of the show. His hands ranged constantly across his lap, lightly freckled with strawberry blonde hairs sprouting at the knuckles. He squinted into the spotlights as he spoke. "Without the handlers to act as a catalyst, our nation would have been too demoralized to continue the fight for freedom. Women wouldn't be able to drive in Saudi Arabia. Iran would still be a theocracy. The new Palestinian territory would have never been carved out of Jordan and Syria. From that perspective, the handless may be the most patriotic Americans of the decade." "That's not why they're heroes," someone in the audience shouted, rushing towards the stage. While security went to calm her down, the show cut straight to commercial, skipping the question-answer session and sparing us all the same tired whining about how Saudi Arabian women are free not only to drive, but to die in car bombs, too. My section of the programme was the same old questions about Fomba and Sierra Leone, except that the camera stayed focused on me long after the hostess should have gone on to some weeping mother who'd done her son with the family chainsaw. The phantom pain in my hands flared up and I caught myself scowling. Bad for business. I shifted the expression to wounded hound. Gesturing for the camera to follow her into a close-up, the hostess mounted the stage, clutching her microphone with tarnished, tan fingers. She knelt beside me, and it occurred to me that if I'd had a left hand, it would have been on her tit. "The producers and I have been looking into your life, Momadou," she said. "You don't have many friends or relatives. We're worried about you. Wouldn't it be wonderful to be with others of your kind, people who understand your pain. She smiled merry sunshine at me and flung her arm toward the wings. 10 men edged on stage. Cheap plastic prosthetics, mostly, except for one top-of-the-line pair with realistic joints, the kind I should have had. The hostess gestured for me to stand, so the circuit had found a new way to extract the sap. They wanted us to hug. The audience cheered as I pulled myself slowly to my feet, and when I came to the first man, I fainted to the side as if too overcome for a hug. "Are we going to let Momadou go back to being alone?" the hostess asked the audience. Choruses of "Go on, do it, and just give him a hug!" urged me forward. I pretended to consider their reactions as if torn. When I finally stumbled into the other guy's arms, relieved applause showered the studio. The man and I started weeping. I bit my cheek. I didn't know what he did to get the faucet started. We reached around each other's backs, but bent our elbows like chicken wings, so our stumps wouldn't touch. That would have been too personal. Oh yeah, the audience bought it. Tissues rose in the crowd like paper ghosts. What they don't understand is, handless don't need community. If we're water, it's oil, or vice versa. Having no hands, you realise how potent the sense of touch is in the rest of your body. You feel socks scraping your feet, dirty hair prickling your scalp. When you want to remember what a flower feels like, you rub one against your cheek, and it's soft. It is soft. But there's something about the language of touching hands that knocks down the walls of separate flesh. A pop psychiatrist who analysed me on one of these shows claims the handless have problems with intimacy because of the sudden shock of brutality in a trusting relationship. But it's more than that, I know. Hands are the pen that inscribes trust on the soul. I boo-hooed my way through the line until I got to the end. A white guy in a wheelchair. Barry. Barry had no prostheses either, which made us the only ones. I leaned over to do the chicken wing thing, and he threw his arms around me and pushed his stumps against my spine. And as he touched me, my pain blazed, and involuntary tears scalded my cheeks. "You're my hero," he whispered. "You gave me the courage to do what I did." I was trapped because the cameras were on, so I bit my cheek harder to squeeze out just a few more tears, then pressed my forehead into the crook of my elbow. "I need to sit down," I said, stumbling back. The hostess rushed to help me to my chair. Next, she wheeled Barry's chair next to mine. Barry was big. Not really fat, just the kind of big tall guys get. Despite some blonde stubble prickling his chin, he looked young and fresh, like TV pictures of high school athletes. He wore a maroon baseball cap and a green plaid blanket over his arms and legs, so his stumps didn't show. When it got to be his turn to speak, he peeked over at me. "I'm not like most handless," he said. "I volunteered for the army. I was in Iran for a few months in Hamadan. What got to me were women at windows. You wondered who they were. Was the man you were shooting at her husband? Her brother? How could you kill this woman's brother while she watched?" Colour mounted his cheeks. "I came back home on leave and I tried to talk to my dad. He was an Air Force man. He was furious when I said I wasn't going back. He said he'd cut me. I told him that didn't matter, I still wouldn't go, so he went after me. We were in the kitchen. He knocked me back and I hit my head on the stove and he said if I didn't change my mind, he'd cut off my feet too." Barry dragged his blanket up. Two metal bars jutted out of his pants, disappearing into his sneakers. "I had to do what I could to keep things from getting worse over there," Barry concluded. "I knew I could live through whatever Dad did to me because Momadou did." The audience erupted into applause. Barry looked like he wanted to hug me. Again. But the hostess commandeered the camera. "Our producers have prepared a phone list for the 10 of you. We'll hand it out at the end of the show. We hope you'll be able to support each other through these tough times." Barry turned a goofy grin toward me, and I knew I was fucked. There's a proverb from Sierra Leone about guys who won't leave you alone. You can drive me away from your house, but you can't drive me away from your grave. That was Barry. Started with phone calls. I told Minna not to pick up the phone, but she got sick of it ringing, so I told her if she had to answer it, to do it in German. The first time she picked up, she spoke English. Yeah, Mama Doo lives here. She said, well, I flailed for her to stop. I know, our phone goes on and off. Why don't I tell you our address? I stood by the refrigerator, pretending to bash my head against the door. Why did you do that? She frowned at me. All these things they said at the talk show, did you ever stop to think? They were right. You could use someone to talk to besides me. So you gave our address to the sentimental wonder? The things you've been through, you don't talk about them with me. Maybe I'm not the right person. Maybe someone else has been through it. Maybe a man. I didn't like the look she had then. Her eyebrows tilted in concern. Her chubby hands laid out to me in supplication as if she were offering them to me. So it's because he's a man, I said, smirking. So I'm not enough for you. I should have known. It takes more than one man to fill a box. She hates it when I speak in proverbs. She turned away, her face and hands falling into the shadow of her body. Ubelika Arschloch, she said quietly. Every morning, after that, Barry came to our apartment. His Swiss nurse, Arlene, slender fingers, abnormally large knuckles, like knots on string, pushed him to our door and knocked. Barry suggested coffee or lunch, and I said no, 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 until the day Minna invited Arlene in so they could share lunch. It's nothing to do with you, Mama Doo. I just want to talk to someone else who speaks German. Is that okay? And oh, what a coincidence! Barry had to come along too. After that, I couldn't keep them out of the house. Arlene and Minna chattered about German novels while I scowled and Barry stared at me constantly, as if I were a statue of a saint. A few weeks later, over dinner, I told Minna I really, really wanted them to stop coming. I like Arlene, she replied. Maybe you should go out walking in the mornings while she's here. Our visits don't last long. I nodded toward the cup of wine and she lifted it so I could sip. I enjoyed the swipe of her napkin. I could, I admitted. But it's my damn house. She met my eye. I live here too. She sighed and pushed away her plate. You know, Arlene says Barry takes care of himself, almost totally alone. They've set up a toilet he can use on his own. He can open and close the door. He even feeds himself. Don't you want to be able to do that? Pain surged down my forearms and I twisted in my seat. The phantom pain is getting a little bad again. I know Barry is hard for you to take, but I think if you sat down with... I'm in pain, damn it! Can't you see that? Sorry, do you want me to get some ice? No! No, I don't! Just shut up until it goes away! We sat in silence until the pain subsided, and when I could breathe regularly again, I scooted forward in my chair, and I pushed my chest forward, and I pulled my elbows back to make my ribs look prominent, so I'd favour all those photos of pathetic, starving Africans. It's not that I don't like Barry, I said. It's just, I don't like to be reminded of what I've lost. Minna harrumphed, but I saw a subtle shift in her expression. I accepted another sip of wine, and I reclined into victory. I realised something was wrong the next night when Minna began cooking Tafelsplitz, rosti and strawberry pudding. You invited them to dinner, I accused. She smiled. She didn't answer, just buzzed around the kitchen in her bare feet. Her trailing sleeves fell down to her elbows as she dragged the dishes down. When the food was ready, she took the pot of Tafelsplitz off the stove and put it on the table. She dished out food for Barry and me, pre-cutting our portions. I don't like the look of my beef, I complained. Minna pushed my chair closer to the table and tucked a napkin into my collar for a bib. She looked down at me, one corner of her mouth pinched down. I can't help you on my own anymore. Her standing there, looking down, made me think of the hostess, kneeling next to me at the talk show, looking up. Why is it I'm always sitting down when women want to make decisions about my life? The bell rang and Minna went to answer the door. She returned, rolling Barry's wheelchair to the table. He smiled at me, raised his elbow in salutation. Where's Arline? I asked. Arline and I agreed that you and Barry need some time together, said Minna. I'm going to stay and feed you, but I'm not going to talk. You're kidding. She wasn't. Help me with my strap, please, Barry said. Arline put it in the front pocket of my backpack. I wear it on my wrist. Minna reached into the bag on Barry's wheelchair and pulled out a small loop of Velcro with a spork attached. This helps you eat? I could feed myself with it. Sometimes it's messy. I've been practicing with prosthetics that hook onto my elbows, too. The doctors say they could work as well as hands. It's just I'm not good with them yet, so I only really wear them at home. Wouldn't you like something like that, Momadou? Minna asked. I thought you weren't supposed to be talking tonight. I opened my mouth for Minna to feed me. She rolled her eyes, but she did. It was early for dinner. Light still poured through the window over the stove, and Minna didn't need to turn on the lamp. Barry chewed with his mouth open, like a cow. My skin's too sensitive to wear prosthetics. My wrists break into hives. What about you? Acute phantom pain. Really? The doctors can't explain it. Maybe it's psychosomatic. Barry leaned forward, a chunk of brown cud lodged between his teeth. Minna says you're unhappy, Momadou. I'm not unhappy. Oh, he leaned back. Well, I wanted to tell you. You helped me to find the secret to happiness. I mean, I already told you about the one time you saved my life, but really, you did it twice. More fool me. If Barry heard me, he ignored me. The first time you gave me courage to stand up for what I believed in, but the second time, you taught me that I couldn't just stop there. I had to keep doing it, and not just for people overseas, for people close to me too. When I woke in the hospital, after Dad cut me, I was depressed for weeks. Nothing could shake me out of it. Then I saw you on Letterman, and something you said broke my world open. He paused for a moment, his arms raised, the spork dangling off his wrist like a ridiculous charm bracelet. What did I say? An empty bag cannot stand. Oh, a proverb. I have a better one. Put the money in her hand and get her back on the ground. I sneered at Minna, but she stayed true to the silent treatment. If he wants to stand, a man must be full. He can't cut himself off from his fellow men. That's why I went to visit my dad when I left the hospital. An empty bag refers to food. A hungry man cannot stand. But hungry for what? Barry bobbed his head up and down, trying to look sage. When Dad got into prison and looked around at himself and what he'd become, he realized what he'd done was wrong. He says when he gets out that he's going to make signs with my picture on them and march outside Washington every day until the war stops. He says that he knows now making it okay to kill anyone makes people think that it's okay to hurt everyone. Otherwise, how could he have done this to me? I have no idea, I said, contemplating the logistics of cutting out Barry's tongue. Exactly. Barry reached to put his stump on my arm and missed. It rested where my hand should have been. What are you doing? He looked down. Sorry, he said, moving his stump to my shoulder. Have you forgiven your uncle? Excuse me! He's a deeply troubled man. The prison doctors pump nutrition into Fomba through an IV when he gets close to starving. That's his deep trouble. I glared at Minna. This whole conversation was her fault. Don't you have anything to say? She looked to Barry. Did you really let your father cut you so you wouldn't have to go back? Barry nodded. I slammed my stumps on the table. You want proverbs? How about this one? A dick is a dick, even if it has no hands or feet. Barry's jaw worked as he tried to masticate the idea. I'm not sure what you mean. Shit doesn't have bones, but if you step on it, you'll tiptoe. Forgiving your uncle is like shit. Something is, that's for sure. Try this one. What's your interest in hog money when your father's not a butcher? I don't understand. It means mind your own business! Minna stood. She pulled the napkin out of my shirt and tossed it on the table. I'll call Arline. 20 minutes later, I was still sitting at the kitchen table, but Barry was gone. Minna said goodbye to Arline and I heard her count very calmly to 100. Then she stormed into the kitchen. What the hell were you doing? Even a worm can get angry. She heaved the pot of beef into the sink, tossing the pot holder under the counter. You're a worm, all right. Oh, don't try to make this my fault. It was your bright idea to force the two of us together. Don't blame me when something this obvious happens. Turning on the sink, she blasted water into the pot. If you throw ashes, she recited, ashes will follow you. I'm not making trouble for anyone. I just want to be left alone. Du armes Kind. She paused a moment before translating. Poor baby. She leaned over the stove to collect the potholder. As her sleeve trailed over the burner, a flame flashed onto her arm. She'd forgotten to switch the burner completely off, and bright daylight had swallowed the flicker of flame. Even after I knew it was there, the fire remained invisible. Red and yellow raced towards Minna's shoulder. She raised her arm at an awkward angle like a cut marionette. Her body drew taut around the fire, as if it had become her centre of gravity. Slowly, her eyes widened, and then she shrieked, flapping at the flames with her free hand. I sat rigid. My knuckles throbbed as if I was clutching my chair. Minna's shock metamorphosed into a hideous, sustained wail. Finally, she pitched herself on the floor, writhing on the tile until the fire vanished in a veil of smoke. She lay still, tears streaking her mascara into jagged raccoon stripes. The smoke alarm bled. I coughed. Finally, I realized I should talk. Shit, what was that? I asked. Are you okay? Minna didn't answer. She reached up to switch off the stove and grabbed for my stump. Come on, she growled. Her hand closed on the place Barry had tried to touch me earlier, the space where my hand should have been. I felt her pull me up by nothing. She dragged me into the hallway and slid down the wall into a crouch. Burns sketched red swirls like henna down her arm. Were you going to sit there and watch me burn? What could I do? You could have tackled me, or turned on the water faucet with your elbow, or screamed for help. I don't have any hands. You could have gotten out of your goddamn chair. 24 hours later, my house was scoured clean of hand lotions and thimbles and nail files. I don't know why I ever thought you were a hero, Minna said. Of course I'm not a hero. That's all my life has been since Fomba cut me. Save my war, be my martyr, raise my flag, inspire my son, take my pity, be what I tell you to be. Why the hell should I? I'm not Barry. He sat down. He anteed up. I never asked to get dealt in. Papa shoved me into the chair. Fate dealt me suicide kings, and Fomba ensured I couldn't even pick up the hand. I never gave a rat's shit hole whether we blew up a city or sniped civilians or covered the whole Middle East in marzipan, as long as I didn't have to bloody do it. Roll on the floor your own damn self, America. You could put out the fire without Momadou. He looks out for his own damn self. When Minna finished packing, I followed her to the threshold. She was laden with suitcases, her arms bulging with muscles I hadn't noticed before. What am I going to do without you? I asked. She shrugged. I don't know. She walked out without looking back. I kept thinking about the man she'd end up with. Someone she wouldn't have to feed. Someone who could shave his own beard. Someone who could lift her chin and guide her into a kiss. I spent the day after Minna left raging. No Barry, no dinner. No dinner, no fire. No fire, no suitcases. No questions about heroism. No empty apartment. And then the most unexpected thing happened. The war ended. The landlady came up to tell me. She helped me to her apartment to watch the incoming reports on TV. After 75,000 American deaths and fighting that sprawled into 12 countries, America finally declared a draw and pulled out. The stated reason was that we had accomplished our objectives by securing freedom for the native populations and, of course, protecting America from its enemies. As for the unstated reason, there was quite a lot of conjecture. Maybe it was Israel finally withdrawing its troops, or the outbreaks of hemorrhagic fever in Kenya and Uganda, which were too close for comfort, or maybe Senator Minta, whose eldest son's death in combat 6 months before had persuaded the previously patriotic partisan to throw his full weight into departure, finally managing to call in the last of his favours. But whatever the reason, we had suddenly gone to peace. A few hours into the coverage, a female news anchor with large, masculine hands read a statement Fomba had sent to the TV stations. Fomba Karoma, the man who cut off his nephew's hands, triggering the craze that produced nearly 400 handless, writes from his cell. Politicians can end the war, but they end nothing. The struggle rages in the heart of this country, bringing glory to the brave and damning the cowards. The camera angle zoomed in close to her face. She took a moment for a reaction shot and continued. Karoma also writes that he will continue his hunger strike even though the war is over. Sources at the prison say that due to long-term lack of nutrition, Karoma's health remains in decline. So I've got everything wrong, have I? Minna leaving wasn't Barry's fault. Komba lay at the root of all my problems. And if he was ill, this could be my last chance to hurt him. After 5 years of starving himself but not being violent to anyone else, Fomba was in medium security prison. The security guard, a tall Lebanese, chattered as he searched me for drugs and weapons. His hands were sweaty and red, his fingernails chewed to the cuticle with a precise, even bite. He placed his right hand on my back and rubbed thoughtfully. "Waited long enough, didn't you? We had a pool on when you'd come to see the thin man. After a couple of years, everyone's time was gone, so we paid off the guy who said you'd never make it. Now the war's over, and here you are. Think I can get my money back?" He led me through the prison cafeteria. There'll be guards watching, regulations, but we cleared it out like you asked. You and the thin man will be the only ones in there. We entered a tiny, adjacent room. Plastic chairs ringed around tables. Faded vending machines lined the back wall. No matter how big a child is, he's never bigger than the man who raised him. Actually, the proverb says he's never bigger than his father, but Papa's dead. Now Fomba is all I have. Fomba sat at the middle table, presiding over an empty tray. Malnutrition lent his skin a grey cast, and the whites of his eyes had dimmed to the colour of ash. His hands steepled over the tray, fingers woven through each other like shark's teeth, and above, his eyes smouldered, alert, violent embers. I sat in the opposite chair and folded my arms, putting my stumps between us. Fomba laughed. His teeth seemed gigantic in his sunken face, the ribs of an immense creature emerging from a dark sea. "Trying to get rid of your black hands?" "I don't have hands anymore. They're shadows, but they're still there. They follow you, like ghosts." He inspected my stumps, pursing his lips in distaste. "People here want to shit, but they don't want to eat. They're spoiled Americans, even the black ones. What I wouldn't give for one of my guns." For an instant I saw him through his eyes, a martyr remaking himself as he'd once pieced together the remnants of dead weapons, transforming flesh to will through starvation. He was never going to forgive me. He was never going to whimper regrets. He knew exactly what he was doing when he cut me. It was nothing he hadn't done before. I wanted to hurt him. Like a revelation, I realized I could. Laying my stumps on the table, I moved my head close to his. "Put your hands over my wrists. Lean in." He looked wary. "Trust me, I can't hurt you. The guards are watching." Up close, his eyes were ill and wavery, bright lights in shivering night water. I put my mouth next to his ear and began to shake and breathe rapidly so from behind it would look like I was crying. The guards shuffled behind us. "You want to die, don't you?" I asked. "Why go on fasting? I brought you some pills. Take them tonight and they won't be able to stop you." Fomba's eyes were hungry, but his tone remained skeptical. His tongue ranged over his teeth, leaving a sheen of saliva. "How did you get them in?" "They don't suspect me. Why would I help you?" "Why would you?" "A peacetime present." I smiled and breathed into his ear. "I want you to die." Fomba's hands inched up my arm. His breaths became short and shallow with desire. "Give them to me." I took the moment to drink in his strained muscles, his trembling want. Then I let the grin spread outwards. "I don't have any drugs." A beat. Vitriolic with victory, I added, "Really, Fomba, what did you think I could carry them in here with?" His expression should have deadened with disappointment. Instead, his features seized into a grimace. He tightened his grip on my arm, fingers digging between layers of muscle as he pulled my stumps off the table. I struggled. He laughed. "Cocky Marmaduke. Strutting Marmaduke. Look now." My eyes seized on our arms. There were hands in Fomba's grasp, huge and black and ugly. My hands, textured like smoke, fingers gnarled into branches. As I watched, they twisted into new malformations like nimbus clouds whipped by furious wind. The guards pulled Fomba off me and pinned his arms. "That's a ticket back to high security," one of them said. Fomba turned to respond, but the beginning of a proverb turned into a strangled yelp. He fell, legs clattering against the chair. The Lebanese shouted, "He's having a fit!" and ran back for help. As his footsteps fell in the hallway, another guard came in, assessed the situation, and came up to me. "I think we should go, sir," he said, placing his hand on my elbow. Gently, he guided me into chaos. I heard guards' footsteps halt as we passed. Convicts shouted catcalls of praise and condemnation. One note above the din. "About time someone got the thin man!" As we reached the end of a long corridor, an EMT team rushed past us in a squeak of wheels and rubber soles, and I did not see any of it. I couldn't draw my eyes away from my black hands, the fingers twisted into claws, jagged digits curled towards me, accusing. Peace had come. Fomba was dead. I knew my crime. African sorcery is not Western magic. African witches drill tiny holes in their victims' hands and arms. They possess people's bodies the way a puppeteer manipulates a marionette. When you slit open a witch's chest, you find a heart as soft and yellow as a banana. The prison called to tell me the thin man was dead. Even without my mythical drugs, Fonda had got what he wanted. His doctor called it a stroke. I believe it was something else. Perhaps Fonda's witchcraft finally dissolved his withering body. Fomba cursed me when he cut me. He called the ghosts of my dead hands to haunt me with the sin of cowardice he supposed I'd been guilty of. But instead, he froze me in that moment of apathy when I would have been happy to see the whole world burn as long as I was fireproof. So my phantom pain is caused by phantoms. The black hands Fomba cursed me with are jealous of trespassers. When I think back, I realize I've been seeing them all these years, in my shadow, in misplaced grasps, in the ghost fingers Minna claims to feel when we make love. There are a lot more amputees now in Africa than there used to be. Our army left them behind, victims of landmines and jumpy triggers, and here, in this country, there will be many soldiers returning from the front with missing limbs. How will Americans be able to tell us from them? Who will these men be? What will their nation make of them? I cannot say who these men will become, but this is the best I can do to make sense of my own experience. If you do not make the effort to do good, you will do evil. I should have learned that in my childhood, watching Fomba. But I was too busy listening to his proverbs. Do not suppose redemption comes all at once. Revelation does, but not redemption. By the time I returned from the prison, my black hands had vanished from sight again, but I knew they were still there. The following day, I relearned helplessness. I hadn't realized how much I'd forgotten when I let Minna take care of me. I couldn't cook. I couldn't remove my clothing, fluff my pillow. Minna found me the second day, lying on the bathroom floor. I'd wet myself. "I'm not here forever," she said, helping me out of my soiled clothing, "just until you settle with a nurse." Her hand rested like a spider on the tile, tensing and relaxing with her pulse. "Are you still angry?" I asked. "Of course she's angry." "It's all right for you to be angry," I allowed. She looked away. Her other hand came to rest in the hollow spot behind my knee. "Thank you for coming back. Today there's peace," I figured. If they could make peace, we could. If our government could pull out of a war, then anything can change. The bite in her voice stung. I looked up, startled, and she chuckled. Her fist did not unclench. The next morning, Minna stood in the doorway of our apartment building as she watched me go in. She shivered in a heavy sweater, hands tucked into her armpits. "You're sure you want to go alone?" she asked. I nodded. As I headed down the sidewalk, I felt the pain in my hands lessen a fraction. I imagined my curls of diaphanous vapour drifting away, leaving the ghosts just a little thinner. Travelling without Minna was difficult, but I managed. Strangers helped. An old man in a yellow tie called me a taxi. I gave the driver the address Minna had found in the phone book for me the night before. As we drove through suburban neighbourhoods, I saw celebrations of the new peace, olive branches on parked cars, banners emblazoned with doves hung in windows. Only a few houses showed flags with black stripes instead of red to mourn the war. When we reached our destination, I asked the driver to help me count out the change from my wallet. He surprised me by being honest. I waited until the taxi rounded the corner before turning to climb Barry's front steps. Instead of a knob, his door had long handles. I knocked with my foot. Barry opened the door. He wore prosthetics on his elbows. "Mamadou?" "Hi, Barry." I watched his eye trail down my mismatched clothes and untucked shirt. "I helped dress myself this morning," I explained. He nodded. I shifted my weight. My breath crystallized. "Barry, I need your help. Teach me how to get rid of my black hands." He didn't ask for any explanation. He just wheeled aside to make room for me to enter. Right about now, some of you are probably a little confused as to why this story ran on a skate pod. Superficially, it's a near-future piece with minimal science fiction content, a very slightly altered world history, and if anything, the slightest hint of the fantastical. At first glance, some of you, I'm sure, feel that this isn't an ideal fit. But look closer, and you'll see that this is a story that taps into a rich vein of science fiction that goes back to The Man in the High Castle, and further to the ABC stories of Rudyard Kipling. In all three cases, the story takes place in a world which undergoes one major change, and the dominoes that fall from that lead to very different histories. In Kipling's case, it's the establishment of a world government of sorts by the Aerial Board of Control, and the dissemination of society that extends from that. They're fascinating pieces, by the way, and they're available for free. I'd recommend Marcus L. Rowland's Forgotten Futures for the best examination of them, especially if you're a roleplayer. In The Man in the High Castle, Philip K. Dick creates a Nazi-driven future which, much like the lawn in David Lynch's Blue Velvet, seethes with ambition and personal struggle beneath an apparently tranquil, united surface. The characters are united only by the uniforms they wear and the governments they pay lip service to. If Kipling paints in broad strokes, and Dick uses the I Ching's elegant waves of causality to help his plot, then what Rachel does here, I would argue, is needlepoint alternate history, focusing on one man who, through no fault of his own, changes countless lives. This is alternate history seen through eyes squinting from both the glare of the media and the glare of the oncoming headlights. A struggle for nothing more than a means of controlling your own life when two of the most important tools you could have for the task are taken from you. This, for me, is how this story is science fiction, more so even than the alternate future history element of the piece. Science fiction is a genre intimately linked in my mind with the struggle to achieve, to grow, to reach something better. From the culture of Ian Banks' novels to the reclaimed solar system of Isui Ogawa's magnificent The Lord of the Sands of Time, science fiction has always been about achieving something incredible through struggle. The only difference here is the struggle is not for a planet or a country, but for one man to re-engage with society. And this victory will never quite be complete. The black hands are always there, but in time, they can be used to build something extraordinary. Speaking of extraordinary, let's listen for a moment as the timbers of the Good Ship Escape Pod creak as we steer harder starboard onto the call for donations. As people talked about in the Metacast, we need donations to pay our authors, and at the moment, more than ever. If you can spare it, please consider donating to any or all of the three casts. Podcastle, I talked about at the top of the story, but their dedication to challenging, different, smart fantasy bears repeating. Pseudopod, my usual end of the street, which is, of course, slightly darker and filled with far more men in good raincoats, deals with horror. Under the control of the Editatron 5000 himself, Ben Phillips, it brings you the best in modern horror every week, as well as giving me the opportunity to talk about the overlooked greats of horror cinema. Moving hurriedly on, before I discuss at length why I feel the Mothman Prophecies is so unsettling, there is, of course, Escape Pod, where we are now. Isn't it shiny? And responsible for bringing you the best in modern science fiction. Three shows, three styles, all united in one goal: to bring you the best stories out there. As aims go, That's pretty admirable. Escape Pod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. Our closing quote this week comes from the journalist Chris Hedges. Rape, mutilation, abuse, and theft are the natural outcome of a world in which force rules, in which human beings are objects. We'll see you next week. Until then, have fun.